Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show, hosted by author, investor, money partner, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thanks for joining us. Once again, we're joined by Peter Schiff, president of Euro Pacific Capital and author of Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. Peter, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
In your book, Crash Proof, you continually referred to a four-letter word called save. Do you think the habit of saving is about the, or not saving, is about to cost America? And if so, how?
Well, I mean, savings are the lifeblood of a free market economy. We need to save. And yeah, I mean, savings have been forgotten. In fact, most recently, I think people who owned homes believed that there was no longer need to save, that their savings were going to be accumulated home equity. And, you know, as that home equity is vanishing and people realize how far, you know, behind they've actually fallen, I think you're going to see a resumption of the need to save. In fact, inherent in home ownership should be savings because you need to save up a down payment. Of course, you didn't have to do that recently. And, of course, homes are expensive. You know, when you're a renter, you don't need a lot of savings because if anything goes wrong, you call the landlord. But when you're a homeowner, you need savings because things happen. Things go wrong with houses. They need to be repaired. They need to be maintained. And inherent in being able to afford those things is to have a supply of savings to pay for it. And recently, homeowners looked at their homes not as a cost, but as a source of revenue. You know, people thought that, you know, you earn money on a home. And you know, they looked at it as, you know, as an ATM machine. People are going to start to realize that homes are, in fact, money pits. That, yes, they're pleasurable. They give you shelter and they give you enjoyment. But they're not a source of income. They're an expenditure, and they need to be financed, and you need to have ample savings to be a homeowner. And so all this is going to return. Of course, it's not going to be able to be done without a lot of pain, without a severe recession.
Does it matter that we personally save as long as we have access to the dollar saved by, you know, others and even other countries?
Of course, because, you know, if we're going to borrow money that other people have saved, we have to be able to repay it. You know, that's the key. And if we're not saving ourselves and if we're not producing, then we really have no way to repay the foreigners. And so, you know, it's okay for foreigners to lend us money, but that's only because they think we can pay it back. The minute they realize that we can't, or we can't give them back the real purchasing power when you adjust it for the declining value of the dollar, foreigners are going to cut us off. And I think we're already in the process of that happening. I think we're already being cut off.
How big of a deal is that going to be?
It's a huge deal because we don't have any domestic savings. You know, I mean, the only reason our phony economy has been held together has been because we have access to the world savings. We've been able to borrow money from the world. And we've been using those savings to buy their surplus production because we have inadequate manufacturing ourselves. I mean, most of the products that we're consuming, you know, we're importing them.
There was a lady that recently wrote a book talking about going without buying anything from China for a whole year.
Good luck. What's she going to, you know,
she raced, yeah, that's what she found. It was impossible. It took her 4 months to buy a pair of shoes.
Yeah, and then if she's going to say, look, I'm not going to buy anything imported. I'm just going to buy stuff that we make. I mean, she's, you know, what is she going to do?
Well, she paid a lot more, and she bought a lot less is what she did.
Exactly, and that's what every American is going to experience. That's going to define the American landscape for a while. We're going to buy a lot less and pay a lot more for it.
Why? I need to understand, why is it that equity and assets aren't the same as savings to the economy of a country?
All right, well, it's key. I mean, what savings represent is when you earn money but don't spend it. Okay, it's the difference between what you earn and what you spend. And what happens is when you don't spend money, you those resources that you didn't use up are available to be loaned out to an entrepreneur who can now invest that money in capital formation and building a business. So it's the process of forming capital that is financed through savings, through underconsumption. And it's so important if an economy is really going to grow to be able to produce more consumer goods in the future, entrepreneurs and business need access to savings. So people have to underconsume. That's the way it goes. Now, from an individual perspective, you know, he's indifferent to whether his wealth is growing by way of savings or whether his assets are appreciating. But to society as a whole, there's a huge difference between legitimate savings and just a paper appreciation of assets. And, you know, if if somebody loses their job, and you can think about it this way, you know, if you have a store of savings and you lose your job, okay, it's very easy. You can tap into your savings. But let's assume your savings represent home equity. Well, if you need to tap into those savings, you need to sell your house, or you need to borrow against your home, which means you need to tap into somebody else's savings. That's a big difference. If you have your own savings and you need to access it, nobody else has to do anything. But if you're relying on an asset, then you have to either borrow against it or sell it. And, you know, sure, everybody can tap in their savings, but, you know, if a lot of people are unemployed, can we all turn around and sell our houses? No, because somebody has to buy those houses.
You're talking about a major decline in U.S. consumption. Let me ask you, will that set off pretty much a world recession?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think a lot of people believe that, but they have the cart before the horse. They think that the global economy is driven by American consumption. I think it's the reverse. I think the global economy is driven by foreign production. And if Americans stop consuming, all the factories around the world aren't going to shut down. They're still going to be able to produce. What's going to change is who does the consuming. And so rather than Americans, the consumption is just going to be enjoyed by other people in different parts of the world. I think more proportionally in Asia. Because anything that's produced is going to get consumed. You know, a way to think about it in an easy situation is take a couple, where you have a husband and wife, and the husband works and the wife doesn't. And so all the income is from the husband, but let's say the wife spends a good deal of the income on going to the beauty parlor, on her clothing and her own personal things, and so the husband's paycheck needs to support the wife. Let's assume that they get a divorce, and assuming there's no alimony payments, they go their separate ways. Is the husband now in trouble because he no longer has a wife to spend his money? No, he's still working. He's still generating the income. What's going to change is what the money is spent on. So maybe he'll buy that sports car that he couldn't buy before because the income was being spent by his wife.
Okay.
I mean, the key is to produce the wealth. Anybody can spend it. So if Americans don't buy the Chinese products, the products are still there. So now the Chinese will buy them themselves. And people say, well, the Chinese can't afford them. Yes, they can. The only reason they can't afford them now is because the U.S. dollar is so much higher than the yuan. But if the Chinese government lets the dollar collapse and the yuan goes up, then whatever purchasing power we had now transfers to the Chinese, and they simply buy their own products. And now they don't have to pay the cost of shipping across the Pacific Ocean.
Okay. Do you see the U.S. having a big problem causing the stock markets around the world to have a problem, or do you think, once again, that's going to cause the opposite?
Well, I do think that stocks are going to go down, as a function of liquidity, and certainly companies that export a lot to the United States, those particular companies will suffer. But I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity for companies that, are domestically focused abroad, companies that, do not export to the United States, that will benefit from the increasing purchasing power of foreigners. And ultimately, I think a lot of the companies that do export heavily to the United States will refocus their efforts and export to other countries. And so ultimately, these companies will snap back. But I do think in the short run, stocks could go down all over the world, including the stocks that I've been buying for my customers at Euro Pacific Capital. But I do believe that the dollar will fall so much that even if some of the foreign stocks I'm buying decline, American investors won't notice the decline. They'll still look like an increase to an American because when they look at the dollar prices will still be rising. And, of course, the most important aspect of the stocks that I'm recommending to my clients is the yield, the dividends. And even if the short-term stock price goes down in euros or in Singapore dollars, I think the dividends that they throw off will go up dramatically. And so they will be a good source of income and needed cash flow during difficult times that lie ahead. So I think it's very important that people, own these types of stocks.
You once referred to the inflation index as the cost of surviving, not the cost of living. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's the way the government has kind of dumbed it down. If you look at some of their favorite indices, like the personal consumption expenditure index, the PCE, that the Fed thinks is the most important indicator to watch. And what that does is, in addition to all the hedonic adjustments that the CPI has, they rely heavily on substitution, meaning that if the price of something like steak goes up, they'll just assume that you didn't buy it because you were a smart shopper and you didn't buy steak. Instead, you bought chopped meat. And chopped meat is less expensive than steak, so that'll bring the index down. Mm-hmm. And you know, and so, well, instead of buying, you know, this cashmere sweater, you bought one made of polyester, or you know, you'll and even though that's inherently a reduction in quality, and should you know, you would think that they would account for that, but they don't. So in my book, I use the analogy. I said, you know, according to the way the government calculates prices, you can have a situation where a guy is sitting in a fancy dining room, and he's got, you know, electricity, and he's eating filet mignon. And he's sitting, you know, just in a, you know, in a t-shirt, you know, in a regular shirt, or you know, and then you know, you fast forward, the guy's he's in a dark room with lit by candles. He's huddled, you know, he's got a jacket on, or he's huddled up in a blanket because he's cold, and you know, because he can't afford heat, and he's eating a can of cat food. And if the price, you know, but the price is the same. So the government says, look, what's the difference? He still has food, he's still warm, and he still has light. and so, therefore, there's no inflation because he's still, you know. So that's what the government is doing. They're not measuring what the cost of living, just the cost of surviving. And they're trying to say, as long as we can live on this money, then there's no inflation. Which, of course, is all nonsense. I mean, we know. I mean, look, I was down at the Wall Street Journal like 2 weeks ago. They were doing an interview, and in the lobby where I was waiting above the building, they had a framed picture of the Wall Street Journal front page from the day in 2000 where the Dow Jones first broke 10,000. And somebody would think, well, gee, the Dow was at 10,000 in 2000, and now in 2007 it's at 10,300, so it's up 30%. But if you look at the picture of that Wall Street Journal, in the upper right-hand corner, you see the price of the newspaper was 75 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the Wall Street Journal costs $1.50. So the paper has doubled in price over 7 years. You know, I mean, so the Dow would have to be at 20,000 to have kept pace with the increase in the cost of that newspaper. And I think the same is true for a lot of other prices. I think the price of a lot of things have doubled and more in the last 7 years. But the government keeps telling us, based on their indices, that inflation is 2% a year. I don't believe that for a second.
The way they determined inflation in the 70s, say 70 through 80, I mean, it was obvious we had inflation and they didn't deny it. Do they calculate it different? Did they change?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, they changed it. They changed it in I think, the late 70s or early 80s, and then they changed it again dramatically in the late 90s under, you know, and so we don't calculate it anywhere near the same. The formula, the methodology for calculating the CPI is very different. In fact, some people have tried to recreate the old method and try to calculate inflation into CPI based on the old method, and you know, this guy John Williams, I think, has been doing it as shadow government statistics. And according to his work, annualized inflation is running at about 10% a year if you would calculate it based on the old 1970s formula. And you know, that makes a lot more sense to me based on what I'm experiencing in my own life when I go and look at prices. You know, 10% feels a lot closer to reality than 2 or 3%.
In your book, you mentioned the way to determine that a government has a solid currency is to look at the balance of payments. So how does the U.S. Pass that test?
Well, I mean, we have the worst, you know, we have a huge, you know, we have a $60 billion a month trade deficit practically. We have a huge negative the balance of payments. And, you know, a lot of the people, the mainstream economists now just brush this aside. They say, well, this is no problem. You know, they say it's a sign of how strong our economy is because we're consuming so much. And this is, you know, this is nonsense. I mean, I use the analogy in my book that it's like a student coming home with an F on his report card and trying to convince his parents that it stands for fabulous. I mean, it's obvious that, I mean, a current account deficit has always historically been, you know, a negative.
Okay.
You know? And it's amazing that people buy into this nonsense.
Well, you know, I think part of it is that it continues to appear to be working. I think that's why. So California.
Well, it's not working. Obviously, look what's happening now in our markets. But it was only working to the extent that, you know, we were getting away with it. I mean, yeah. I mean, you can live off your credit card, your Visa, and your MasterCard, and you can say, yeah, look, it's working. Yeah, but it doesn't work forever. Eventually, you run out of credit. Eventually, you can't get another credit card, and you have to get a job. I mean, you know, a phony lifestyle based on borrowed money doesn't last forever.
Well, you know,
or it's the same. It's like that analogy: the guy jumps off the top of the Empire State Building, and you know, halfway down. Well, so far, so good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean.
A lot of the economists that tell these big industries what's coming have been telling them that this is not a problem, that it's a soft landing. I've seen you debate some of these people. I've debated some of them myself, and they have told builders, for instance, that everything was fine right up until about 6 months ago.
Well, this is all, of course, because that's all they do. People look to Wall Street or the government for answers as if they're going to get some objective opinion. They're not. They're going to get hype. They're going to get spin or propaganda, whatever you want to call it. These guys are constantly going to, you know, I described it, you know, when these guys a year ago, when they were talking about, when they first started talking about soft landing, you know, this guy David Lurier, who was the chief economist, and in my book, I said, look, if he was covering the arrival of the Hindenburg, he would have described it as a soft landing. You know, I mean, it's obvious that this is a crash landing, but they're never going to say that. Nobody in government, no one on Wall Street is going to say that. But you know what? You know, I think you don't have to look to what they say. Look at what they're doing. Look at what's happening to the value of mortgage brokers. Look at what's happening to home builders. I mean, if you want to think there's going to be a soft landing in the real estate market, look at the prices of home builders. I mean, these stocks like Rylan, like, look at Beazer. Beazer's at $11. It was at $80. You know, I mean, D.H. Horton is at $16.80. Southern Standard Pacific is at $10.50. All these stocks were $70, $80 stocks a year ago. These stocks are down 70, 80%. How can that be a soft landing? Is that? I mean, if there was a soft landing, I mean, would these real estate, would these companies be collapsing in price, the ones that build houses? And then look at the people, look at the banks, look at the lenders, look at the people that provide mortgage insurance. These stocks are not just going down. They're getting destroyed.
Do you expect that we're going to have some major names, either builder or lender, not exist in the next couple of years?
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that I'm sure there's going to be some major bankruptcies in the real estate, in the home builders and the lenders. But, you know, I don't know which ones they're going to be. But, you know, even if they don't go bankrupt, doesn't mean that they're not, the stock prices can't collapse even more. I mean, I think home building, for example, is an industry that's really going to have to be on hiatus for about 5 or 10 years, maybe more, because I think for the past, you know, 5 years, we've overbuilt so dramatically. We've built so many houses that we don't need and that people can't afford that it's going to be a long time before anyone builds another one, because if you want a house, there's going to be plenty to choose from. There's going to be no reason to build one. And I think that the houses are going to actually sell for prices that are far less than the cost of constructing them anyway. So it's not even going to be economical. Why spend, you know, $300,000 to build a house that's only going to be worth $200,000 when you're finished? So, you know, it's just going to be a long time before that industry comes back.
In the early 70s, I was a young man, probably 22 years old. I read a book that was written by Howard Ruff, and it's named The Coming Bad Years. And I remember in that he suggested buying 200 pounds of wheat for every person in your family. Not to be short, I bought 1,000 pounds of wheat, and 30 years later, I'm down to 50 pounds. Do you think it's time to stock up?
Well, look, I think wheat prices are going up. I mean, inherent in the belief that you actually have to own the wheat itself.
You know, I guess what
belief that, you know, you're not going to be able to get it, that there's going to be shortages or embargoes or I don't know. I mean, I don't know if it's going to get that bad. I mean, but I do think that if you have foreign assets or precious metals, you'll be able to afford to buy wheat. You know, you won't have to worry about it, and hopefully we'll still have access to it. But I have advised in my book, I said, look, you know, it's one of the things I have advised that people do that don't have a lot of money is just to save nickels and save pennies, you know, especially the pennies from before 1981, because they're worth, you know, two or three times their face value already. And the nickels are worth more than their melt value, so you can hang on to those. If somebody wants to buy, I've recommended stocking up on things like, you know, razors or razor blades or shaving cream or deodorant or different things that don't go bad. That if you don't have a lot of money to invest, these things are just going to get more expensive. I don't think that they're necessarily going to be shortages. I don't know that. I'm hoping that it doesn't become that bad. But they're certainly going to get more expensive. And it's certainly, you know, so, you know, why not buy them now? You know, I mean, certainly clothing coming, if you have a kid, you know, if you want to buy, you know he's going to grow. You can buy the clothes he's going to wear next year and the year after that. You know, while you can still get them really cheap because the prices of these things are going to go up.
One of the major premises of your company is that there's always a bull market somewhere. And that's a fascinating statement. But let me ask you, can that somewhere be an asset class rather than a location? And do you see where the next bubble's likely to be?
Well, sure. I mean, we invest globally. But, yeah, you know, you're going to have bubbles. And I've said I thought there was ultimately going to be a bubble in precious metals, you know, a bubble in, you know. But, I mean, I think we're a long way from even being towards the final stages of a bull market, which would produce a bubble-like conditions. I mean, right now I still think that, the, you know, things like gold or silver are way undervalued. So we're But ultimately, you know, most bull markets do end in bubbles. I mean, people do get kind of euphoric and a little bit crazy towards the later stages of a bull market. We saw that in stocks in the late 1990s. We saw it in real estate recently. And I think we will see it in other asset classes where people make a lot of money.
Absolutely.
Because people always look in the rearview mirror, and they see that people have made a lot of money doing something, and so they want to do it. And then they extrapolate, and they think it's going to happen forever. And it becomes, you know, like a no-brainer, like real estate is. You know, you can't lose. You know, there's the only way to lose in the real estate market is not to own, you know, is not to be in it. No matter how much you pay, it's only going to go up. It's a one-way street. And so, you know, those types of attitudes, you know, take hold of the psyche, you know, towards the latter years of bull markets.
This is a quote in your book. If we knew the collapse was tomorrow, we would put everything in cash or near cash. My question is, in what currency or what type of liquidity would you choose?
Well, I mean, obviously, but looking around, I mean, the yen is doing really well during this environment right now. And then in the thing, I like the Singapore dollar, though, a little bit better than the yen. So I like the Singapore dollar for Asia, and I like the Swiss franc for the European currencies. And so I think, you know, Singapore dollars and Swiss francs are probably two good currencies to hide out in, you know.
The yen is doing well against the euro as well?
The yen is doing well against everything for the past few weeks. The yen is, in fact, today, you know, it's the only currency that's up against the dollar. You know, and so, and this is the currencies that have been the most heavily borrowed. These are the currencies that have been financing, you know, these carry trades.
How would your investment strategy differ from somebody like Warren Buffett, who's also been involved in?
My strategy is very similar to Warren Buffett's. You know, buy and hold, buy value. You know, if you look at what Warren Buffett is doing with the cash flow in his Berkshire Hathaway, he's been buying foreign assets. I mean, he's been diversifying out of the United States and been making investments abroad. I mean, he's doing the same thing that I'm doing. I mean, the reason that Warren Buffett can't, you know, take all the assets in Berkshire Hathaway, because he has these huge positions. And also, you know, a lot of the stocks that I'm buying are simply too small for Warren Buffett at this point, because he's got too much money under management. He needs to buy, you know, big stocks, you know, that he can take over. But I think if Warren Buffett were just starting out, or, you know, kind of where, you know, my clients are, I think the stocks that I'm buying for my clients are exactly the types of stocks that Warren Buffett would be buying. I mean, he'd probably be a client of mine if he was in his, you know, 30s or 40s, and I'd call him. He'd be right on board with what I'm doing.
What would you suggest? Let's say there's been somebody conservative, actually, that owns a lot of assets in the United States, but maybe decides that what you have in mind is a good idea. What would you suggest their portfolio be made up of in the next few years?
Well, just exactly how I laid it out in my book, in Crash Proof. But I think that the majority of the money should be in good, conservative, yield-oriented foreign stocks in Europe and Asia, and things like utilities and property trusts and natural resources and pipelines and refineries and alternative energy and all sorts of basic yield-oriented investments. And then I think you should have a portion in physical precious metals and some in more speculative mining stocks.
Okay.
You know, and in energy plays. I think that's the way to go. And if you want to have some money in cash, because, you know, make sure it's just not U.S. dollars. You know?
How would somebody look you up in the web? You have a website that you can mention?
Yeah, I mean, my website, there's all kinds of good information on there. You know, www.europac.net. You can watch, you know, over 100 or so video interviews on Fox and Bloomberg and CNBC. And some of them are quite hysterical, because now you can read them you can watch them with the knowledge of hindsight, and you can see how right I was and how wrong these people are. And, of course, the people that were so wrong are still on there touting the same old nonsense.
I agree.
And a lot of the stuff that's happening right now, people were laughing at me, literally laughing at me when I was making these predictions, and a lot of it has already come true. And there's a lot of my economic commentary going back a few years, so you can see and read what I've been writing about real estate and the dollar and gold and commodities for years, and you can see how accurate these predictions have been. And I've got my own radio show I do on that site every Wednesday. You can listen to me live for an hour, or you can listen to a couple years of archive programming on there, and you can order my book, Crash Proof. Also, there's information how to open up an account online and get started, you know, and talk to one of my brokers and talk about, you know, moving an account over to Euro Pacific.
Okay. Peter, thanks so much for taking time to join us. I know you're a very busy man, and I really appreciate it. I learned a lot.
Great. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or email questions and or comments to radio@thenorrisgroup.com. We'll see you next week at 5:30 here on News Talk 590 KTIE.